Chapter 15. The December 19th Hearing and Damages. In our opinion, Dr. Mikovits has been hometowned from the outset of the criminal and civil cases by the Washoe County criminal justice system as the result of undue influence exerted by WPI's owners. But issuance of the warrants pales in comparison with the bail hold placed on Dr. Mikovits, which prevented her from bailing out of jail in Ventura County for the better part of a week, and severely limited her ability to participate in her defense to WPI's motion for preliminary injunction. Dennis Neal Jones, Dr. Mikovits's lead attorney in the civil case, asked the court for permission to appear at the preliminary injunction by telephone because he was recovering from knee replacement surgery and he was physically unable to attend the hearing. The court refused his request, forcing Jones to arrange a last-minute replacement unfamiliar with the case to attend the hearing. From a planned but unreleased press release by Mikovits's attorney, Dennis Neal Jones. December 15, 2011. Judy Mikovits was sitting in the lobby of the Lucerne Hotel in New York City when she got a call from her attorney, Dennis Jones. She and Frank Rossetti had traveled to New York to work with Ian Lipkin of Columbia University, who had been given the task by NIH of determining why some groups had been unable to find XMRV among the ME/CFS patient population, while others like Lowe and Alter had found it. Maureen Hansen of Cornell University and journalist Hillary Johnson were also present for the meetings. Since her termination only 3 months earlier and arrest on November 18th, Mikovits had flown largely under the radar, avoiding the press and publicity. After a few words, her attorney got to the point and told her she needed to come back and appear at a hearing in Reno on December 19th, 4 days away. Mikovits told her attorney that he was out of his mind, that she was in New York City, and not going to any court controlled by the Whittemores. She then used some colorful language common to many New Yorkers about what the Whittemores should do to themselves. While the language she used may have passed without much notice to the majority of the denizens of the Big Apple, the staff at the upscale Lucerne Hotel expected such language to be left on the street. By their disapproving looks, they were telling her to keep her voice down. Jones tried to convince Mikovits that she would get an unbiased hearing before Judge Adams and that she needed to go. "This is ridiculous," she shouted into the phone. "You don't understand. There is no way you'll get a fair shake in that courtroom." Jones attempted to soothe her. "We decided you're going to take the Fifth Amendment, and I'm still comfortable with that. But you've got to produce your personal emails, all 22,000 of them. We really don't have any leeway on that." In the preliminary issued while Mikovits was held in a Ventura County jail, Judge Adams had given Mikovits 2 weeks to sort through all 22,000 emails and decide which were personal and which were professional. Under normal circumstances, this would be a difficult task with an unfair time frame, but since the police had taken all her electronics, leaving her without a computer, this was an especially impossible task. "Over my dead body," said Mikovits. She told Jones that when she signed on as the principal investigator, that she was required to protect the identity of the more than 800 subjects who had signed consent forms in the various studies. Mikovits thought her attorney really didn't comprehend the responsibilities of a principal investigator on a government grant. The participants had to know that when they handed their blood or other samples over to the study, their information would never find its way into the hands of an insurance company that might deny them coverage, or physicians who might restrict or deny treatment. Her frustration was at a fever pitch. Jones again tried to convince her that she needed to go to Reno. "You can hold your kangaroo court, but I won't be there, and you will not get my emails. Your attorney promised my personal email. I did not. I was in jail. I told you no. That's not how a principal investigator works." Back in her hotel room, Hillary Johnson, Maureen Hansen, and Frank Rossetti begged Judy to just hand over the emails, fearing that she would be jailed again. But she was firm about not handing over documents containing study subject names. Her plane flew back to Santa Barbara in the early morning hours of December 18th. Mikovits, David, and Dennis Jones went to Reno together later that day. This was the first time she actually laid eyes on Dennis Jones, and the condition of the man was startling, even for someone accustomed to the worst ravages of cancer. Because of the knee replacement he'd undergone in November, he was using two canes to walk with great difficulty. This manner of getting about made it difficult for Jones to schlep his laptop around, so he simply brought his files. This was their champion, teetering about on his canes with his paper files. In the car on the way to the airport, David drove and Dennis sat in the front with him while Judy sat in the back. Jones wanted to discuss a contract Mikovits had allegedly signed on February 22, 2009, claiming that in the event she was fired, she would return all copies of all data to the WPI. Dr. Mikovits looked at the paper and could not recall ever having seen it. She believed the signature page had been taken from another document. February 22, 2009 was almost 3 years after she had begun working to develop the research program of the WPI. The idea that an academic researcher and professor would sign such a clumsily worded agreement that effectively turned her from a professional scientist with rights and responsibilities into an employee for hire was ludicrous. There were other reasons to believe she had never signed it. On January 20th of 2009, she'd signed a joint agreement with the Cleveland Clinic and the NCI for their investigation of XMRV and ME/CFS. The information developed in that joint investigation belonged to all three institutions. This new document claimed it superseded 3 years of collaborative research agreements and that all intellectual property would be owned solely by the WPI. Dennis Jones was astute, but Mikovits worried he didn't understand the bigger picture. "This isn't about grants and legalities of grant management. This is about a setup, a frame-up, and a cover-up. That's what you need to see." Mikovits knew the notebooks would provide the evidence that VIPDX's XMRV test was worthless, and she believed the Whittemores knew it too. There was also the possibility that the lab data contained in the notebooks would provide clues to help her understand ME/CFS, autism, and other diseases. Who knew what kind of windfall could come from curing those diseases? As Judge Adams opened the hearing at 9:03 a.m., things started badly and only got worse. The Whittemores were represented by Ann Hall, whose husband worked for the Washoe County District Attorney's Office, which had issued the search warrant for Mikovits's house. To Mikovits, this was yet another corrupt connection between the civil and criminal cases. In addition to Dennis Jones, Mikovits was represented by criminal attorneys Scott Freeman and Tammy Riggs, who had been retained that Monday after Thanksgiving when she was mysteriously required to appear in Reno for Science's mugshot. Mark Saloris, who had appeared on Mikovits's behalf on November 22, 2011, at the Reno hearing while she sat in jail in Southern California, was standing by on telephone. The judge seemed angry that Zalores was not physically present. Jones explained they'd been given only one day's notice of the hearing. Jones then presented his first substantive argument, namely why Mikovits had not provided her requested emails. Jones explained that Freeman had advised her that she could assert her Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination in the criminal case. In addition, she didn't have a criminal lawyer at the time and was in jail in Southern California at the time of the hearing on the preliminary injunction. When she was released, she hired Scott Freeman, and he had recommended that Mikovits invoke her Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination regarding the emails, which she did. Mikovits believed the stronger argument was the one she'd made in New York to her colleagues, the argument that under federal law she was required to protect the confidentiality of patients in the study, but she had chosen to trust the experience of Freeman. Jones proceeded to question why Mikovits was arrested on a no-bail warrant, but Judge Adams returned to whether Mikovits had complied with the order to produce all of the emails. Jones replied that counsel believed that the motion to stay would trump the entire civil case, including your prior order. Adams asked whether Jones understood that the filing of the motion did not stay the court's order to produce the emails. Jones said he did, which was why they had retained a company to copy the emails, but it was taking a significant amount of time. He went on to say that the volume of emails was tremendous, more than 22,000 in all, and that to protect privacy he asked that a discovery master, an independent court representative who would review the documents, be appointed to assist in not revealing patient information. The judge didn't want to offer the services of a discovery master to sort through the emails. He simply wanted all 22,000 of them, regardless of the patient information contained within. Jones protested that they needed one more week to finish copying them, but Judge Adams would not waver, claiming it was inconsistent with the order entered on November 22, 2011. Jones responded by saying it was only inconsistent in date. Judge Adams replied, "Well, it's inconsistent in terms of process. It's inconsistent in every respect, isn't it?" Mikovits sat next to her attorney, incredulous. She would only fully understand 4 months later, on March 14, 2012, when Judge Adams recused himself, admitting accepting more than $10,000 from Harvey Whittemore. Jones said he wasn't sure that the attorney who represented Mikovits in the previous hearing, Mark Zalores, understood a discovery master was available. There was also some concern by Zalores as to whether the emails, simply by being handed over, would become part of the public record. Judge Adams didn't seem to believe these were reasonable concerns. Maybe sensing what Mikovits had warned him, Jones pushed the button for the litigator's most incendiary option. "I just have to say that I am very disappointed and upset with the fact that my client has really been denied effective assistance of counsel by a series of events, including what we believe to be undue influence. In both law and science, the claim of bias or undue influence is a grave charge." Judge Adams responded by asking who had denied her effective assistance of counsel. Jones replied, "Well, you would not allow me to appear by telephone, even though I was on medical leave following surgery, so her lead counsel was not able to participate." From that point, the judge seemed to change topics, all with the purpose of not revisiting his earlier decision. "I'm totally unaware of that, but in any event, Mr. Zalores is also counsel for the defendant. In fact, He's the one who has limited but lengthy experience in the criminal law, isn't he? Jones replied, He is. Judge Adams continued, And finally, couldn't he have advised the court and opposing counsel that we couldn't go forward with the chambers conference because of your unavailability? He never told me that. I certainly wouldn't have proceeded with the chambers conference discussing broad orders concerning issuance of the preliminary injunction and the specific order on discovery if I had been advised that the defendant wasn't represented by counsel. She was represented by counsel, and we had a very extensive chambers conference concerning the terms of the preliminary injunction order and the terms of the clerk's discovery order. Jones replied, I understand that, Your Honor. Understand that he did the best he could under the circumstances, having never spoken with his client. Judge Adams replied, He didn't tell me that he had never spoken with his client. Jones tried to explain again. By the time of the November 22, 2011 preliminary hearing in Reno, Dr. Mikovits had been in jail 5 days, and Jones was the only attorney with whom she had discussed the case, one time, by phone, only 4 days before her jailing. Jones was well enough to appear by phone, but Judge Adams denied this request. After this denial, the best he could do was get another attorney, Mark Zaloris, to appear on her behalf. Zaloris couldn't interview Mikovits because she was imprisoned without an arrest warrant from November 18th to 22nd in Southern California. What is remarkable about the transcript is that even Judge Adams admitted that Zaloris couldn't comment knowledgeably on the Fifth Amendment claim because he didn't know anything about the criminal case. Mark Zaloris could not interview her to get essential facts and background because she was in jail in Southern California. Jones continued to press the bias issue. For those familiar with the severity of the charge of bias against a judge, as well as the subsequent revelation that Harvey Whittemore, family members, and business entities had donated $10,400 to the campaign of Judge Adams, it reads as Kabuki Theater. Jones tried admirably to finesse the accusation of bias, falling just short of outright accusing the judge of corruption. As I said, Your Honor, I'm sure he did the best he could, but he also told me at one point when he called me during the hearing that the handwriting was on the wall. Your Honor was going to sign a preliminary injunction in his opinion, and the best he could do, Jones's implication must have been clear. Just a moment. The hearing was set for the preliminary injunction. That was the time at which the parties were entitled to produce witnesses, evidence, and argument on the motion for preliminary examination. Witnesses did appear, even though the defendant didn't. At the request of counsel for both parties, I met with counsel in chambers, which resulted in the order and the preliminary injunction. If Mr. Zaloris felt that, quote, the handwriting was on the wall, end of quote, he was not only inaccurate, because I hadn't heard any evidence on the motion, didn't prejudge it in any way. Secondly, he never told me that he wished to proceed with the hearing, that he wished he'd hear evidence from the plaintiff or present any evidence on the defendant's behalf, or that he felt in any way coerced or pressured or maneuvered into making a decision on behalf of his counsel. Judge Adams continued, Again, I stress, if he had not literally even talked to his client before the hearing, which I find to be implausible, but if that were the truth, I would expect that would be the number one thing he'd bring to the court's attention. I would not expect that he would enter into by stipulation not only a preliminary injunction, but a detailed order on the discovery process. That just doesn't make sense to me. Does it make any sense to you? Judge Adams refused to accept that substitute counsel had been unable to discuss the particulars of the case with Mikovits while she was in jail in California. Did Judge Adams believe attorney Dennis Neal Jones, the former president of the Ventura County Trial Lawyers Association, was flagrantly lying? If so, Adams should have thrown Jones in jail for contempt of court and violating the canons of professional ethics. To Dennis Jones, there were a number of issues that didn't make sense. Why hadn't he been allowed to appear by telephone? And while the initial claim against Mikovits contained no direct evidence, while she was in jail, the Whittemore side had dropped the bombshell, a new affidavit supposedly written by Mikovits' research associate, Max Post, the day before her arrest, but not part of the November 7th lawsuit. How were they supposed to prepare to defend against this if they were given multiple documents and no time to decipher the truth? His client was in jail, and Jones was recovering from major surgery. It seemed apparent that Judge Adams simply did not believe that Mikovits had not talked with Mark Zaloris before the hearing. Can you imagine any judge anywhere in the United States proceeding with such a conference, the lawyers entering these orders we've talked about, and having been told that the lawyer on behalf of the defendant had never met with the defendant, knew nothing about the case? You think there's any judge in the United States who would do that, except a judge subject to the due discipline under the Code of Judicial Conduct, and in my view, subject to removal? Even if Mark Zaloris hadn't let the judge know he'd never spoken to his client, the judge still claimed that Zaloris didn't know what Mikovits had been charged with, or even where she was being held. That would have alerted the judge that Mikovits's representation in the case was inadequate. At one point, Adams said to Jones, "And I certainly don't think you're suggesting that all that would have occurred had I been told that defense counsel had no witnesses, had nothing to present, didn't know how to counter the witnesses of the plaintiff, and had never even met the defendant." That is exactly what Jones was saying, but for some reason, Judge Adams wasn't accepting it. In his summation of the case, Judge Adams claimed, remarkably, that Mikovits was perhaps the greatest villain to ever darken his courtroom, someone who had to be stopped at any cost. The remedy for this conduct is within the discretion of the court. In my entire tenure on this bench as a presiding judge in Department 6, I have never rendered a default against a disobedient party in a civil case pursuant to NRCP 37B2C. The defendant's willfulness is demonstrated by every fact in this case. She did not comply in any way, shape, or form with the court's order or the terms of the preliminary injunction. She did not timely advise the court or adverse party of her unwillingness, her disability, to perform it for her. The Honorable Judge Brent Adams was appointed to his position on July 4, 1989, which meant when he served as the presiding judge in the case against Mikovits, he had been on the bench for 22 years. According to his own admission, in all that time, he had never handed down a default judgment. A default judgment is the legal equivalent of a nuclear bomb. It means you have shown such disrespect for the court that you will not be allowed to present a defense. Even those who have just a passing familiarity with the American legal system know that every person is supposed to get their day in court. Everybody, it seems, except for Judy Mikovits, when she found herself in a Reno, Nevada courtroom in front of a certain judge. A judge who 3 months later would be revealed to have received a very substantial campaign contribution from Harvey Whittemore. Judge Adams's failure to remove himself from the case, or at least inform the parties and get a waiver from them, would probably have subjected him to an ethics investigation in 49 out of 50 states. The only state which didn't have such an ethics rule and left such issues purely to the judge's discretion? Nevada. The civil action against Mikovits had been filed on November 7, 2011. Mikovits had been unable to appear at the November 22, 2011 hearing because she'd been in jail in Southern California, having been arrested on November 18. Her attorney, Dennis Jones, had just undergone major surgery and had to get a replacement attorney, Mark Zaloris, who was unfamiliar with the case. Zaloris had shared his impression with Jones that the handwriting was on the wall in the case, and Jones even said so directly to Judge Adams. On December 19, 2011, she was found liable as a result of the default judgment handed down by Judge Adams. Dr. Mikovits had gone from having a case filed against her to judgment being taken in less than 6 weeks without being able to present a single piece of evidence. How could anybody reasonably claim this was justice? When the hearing was over, her criminal attorney, Scott Freeman, approached her. He spoke in a low but urgent voice. "If I were you, I'd get out of town just as fast as I could, because I and everybody else sitting in this courtroom thought you were going to be in jail. Get out of here before he changes his mind." So Mikovits, her husband, and Jones hurried back to their hotel, grabbed their bags, and got to the airport 3 hours early. A part of Mikovits wished they had arrested her on the spot. She knew the patient community wouldn't stand for such shenanigans, and the effort might cause the whole thing to blow up in the Whittemores' faces. But then there was David, who was 20 years her senior, and the entire ordeal had hurt him too much already. She didn't know if he could handle her being jailed again. They landed in Los Angeles, happy to be free, but knowing that the dark forces were still operating against them. As if the courtroom antics were not enough, and as if the mugshot was its own permanent tattoo, on December 23, 2011, Science completely retracted the October 2009 article linking XMRV to CFS. Mikovits wondered why no one was asking about the possibility of common scientific practices creating recombinant viruses plaguing the human race and causing a myriad of diseases would never be answered. On January 25, 2012, Judge Adams held a damages hearing. The hearing was quickly moved to his chambers. Mikovits was not present but was represented by her attorneys, Dennis Jones and Scott Freeman. The Whittemores were present with their attorneys, niece Carly West Kinney and Ann Hall, whose husband worked for the DA's office. Since Judge Adams had entered a default judgment against Mikovits, all that was left was to determine the amount of damages Mikovits would pay the Whittemores. And the Whittemores had their number. They wanted Dr. Mikovits to pay them $15 million in damages.